Turn with me in your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews 11, and this morning we'll look at verses 4 through 6. Couples who have been married a long time will often speak of their early years together as the good old days. And if you listen, what you oftentimes will discover is that the reason that they consider them good is because all they had was each other. They didn't have much else. They start off their married life being rather strapped for cash, and they, looking back, discover that, you know, all we had was each other, but that was what was good. The other day, Connie and I were watching an old sitcom from our good old days, and there was a young couple in the sitcom, and what they were doing is, in this one particular episode, is kind of wrangling over what they're going to do on their day off. And one of them wanted to go to see a film, the other one wanted to go see a quilt show, and you can guess which one. And they were kind of wrangling over that. Each wanted his or her own way. And they couldn't decide on a common thing to do that they both would like. And they kind of tried to work out a compromise, but that just really didn't work out. And so what they ended up doing was just sitting on the sofa together, cuddled up, reading the paper, and eating chips. And one of them made this comment. I just want to be with you. And you know, that's what we find in relationships that makes it so good. A good relationship is one where the relationship itself is the blessing. Where being with the other person, just experiencing life with them and just hanging out with them and doing something with them or doing nothing with them is really what makes that relationship good. It's the personal aspect of it. It's the one-on-one connection that you have with that person. But every relationship has rules if it is to thrive. It's that way with our relationship with God. Every relationship has rules, and it requires work to keep the relationship thriving. But in our relationship with God, it's a little bit different. Because instead of kind of agreeing on, okay, what are we going to do this Saturday, and we work together on that. With God, He lays out all the rules. But see, God's not at all like a domineering husband. He's not at all like a manipulative wife. He's God, and He has every right to lay out the rules. He's the Creator, and we're His creatures. Our response is to humbly submit by faith, doing what He says is right and pursuing Him with our whole heart. But you know, in any relationship, the busyness and the hassle of life complicates everything. And it distracts us. Life with all of the stuff and the problems and all that, it just sucks us into this tangled maze, and we forget what's really important. Sometimes we forget the rules. Sometimes we're tempted to break the rules. And very often, we stop working at the relationship. What I want to tackle today is not so much our tendency to let human relationships dwindle, but our tendency to let our relationship with our Creator to decline. You see, what we're dealing with in this section is the bigger theme of walking by or living by faith. What does that mean? You see, if we are walking by faith, if we are living by faith, then it presupposes a relationship to God. It's a relationship that is ongoing. There's this personal one-on-one back and forth, if you will, all throughout the relationship. It isn't something that we just kind of sign up for and we do religious stuff. And no, it's a personal relationship, a personal interaction with God. That's why it's called living by faith. And so if we are to live by faith, a question that we need to answer is, how do we please God? If we're going to live with God by faith, live under God by faith, if we're going to be oriented to God by faith in this relationship, how do we please Him? Now, to the natural mind, that thought may sound awful one-sided. You know, we talk about how, you know, we're talking this morning about how do we, all of us, please God. We're not talking about, okay, well, Lord, this is a two-way deal. Now, how are you going to please us? We don't do that. And so it sounds one-sided to some people. But we have to remember, we're talking about God. We're talking about the one who abounds in loving kindness, the one who pours out loving kindness and grace and mercy on His people, those who follow Him. He is a wonderful God. And what He has for those who seek Him is a breathtaking gift. Follow with me, Hebrews 11, and I want to begin in verse 1. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the men of old gained approval. By faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things which are visible. By faith Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts. And through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. By faith Enoch was taken up, so that he should not see death, and he was not found, because God took him up. For he obtained the witness that before his being taken up, he was pleasing to God. And without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence, prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world, and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. These Hebrew Christians to whom our author is writing were struggling under their Christianity. They made this profession of faith, and life got really, really hard. And they made it through that okay. And it appears that that initial intense suffering possibly let up some. But they're still suffering. Maybe in some new ways. Maybe they're not as intense. They may be more subtle, but they're still suffering. And they've become weary. They're tempted to go back and say, you know, let's go back in time. Let's go back to Moses. And the author says, you want to go back in time? Okay. And he starts pushing them. He says, let's go back. But Moses isn't far enough. Don't go back to the old covenant. You need to go back to the promise of the new covenant. The new covenant. And he's pushing them. The new covenant in Abraham. It was made to Abraham. I mean, it was promised to him. It was the new covenant that would be fulfilled in Jesus, the Melchizedekian priest who would bring about that new covenant that was proclaimed, that was promised so long ago to Abraham. He says, you guys want to go back? And he's pushing them. He says, let's go back even further than Abraham. Well, if we're going back, let's just go all the way back to the beginning. You guys think that what you need to do is go back to the old covenant and try to live by works? He says, you know, if we go back to the beginning and then we start there and we go all the way forward through the men and women of faith, you're going to find that those whom God considers righteous have always been those who live by faith. Works has never, ever been the way to please God. That doesn't mean there's not a place for works. It's that that's not how you please God. You see, it's a mistake for us to think that the old covenant, that the law of Moses, was somehow different than now, in the sense of, okay, under that old covenant law, it was all just about works. Not at all. He's going to say, let's go back even before the old covenant. And while we're at it, let's go back even before the flood. Let's go back to the beginning. And I'll show you that it's always been faith. It's always been by faith, if you want to please God. So I'd like you to follow me as our author takes us back to Genesis chapter 4. So turn back to Genesis 4. And let's read about Abel and refresh our memories on his story. You remember Genesis 1 and 2, God created mankind, Adam and Eve. And then in chapter 3, everything fell apart. They decided that, you know, we're not going to follow God's word. Give us one rule, but that's just too much. We're going to do it our way. And what we call the fall took place. They fell into sin. They chose to disobey God. In chapter 4. Now the man, Adam, had relations with his wife Eve. And she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, I have begotten a man-child with the help of Yahweh. And again she gave birth to his brother Abel. And Abel was a keeper of flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to Yahweh of the fruit of the ground, and Abel on his part also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. And Yahweh had regard for Abel and for his offering, but for Cain and for his offering he had no regard. So Cain became very angry, and his countenance fell. Then Yahweh said to Cain, can you see the grace of God here, the mercy of God? Cain did it his way and got all angry about it. And God's trying to counsel him. Yahweh said to Cain, why are you angry? And why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, or if you do what is right, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do right, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. And Cain told Abel, his brother. And it came about when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Now turn back to Hebrews 11. This is what our author says about this. By faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts. And through faith, though he is dead, he, Abel, still speaks. We need to learn from these men and women of faith in our past, in our history. It's our first point. Imitate Abel. Obey God in worship. Imitate Abel. Obey God in worship. That's what we just read in verse 4. Jesus referred to Abel as a righteous man. The Apostle John in 1 John referred to Abel, to his deeds, as righteous. So here's a righteous man. He did righteous deeds. And our author says he also is a man of faith. By faith he offered a better sacrifice than Cain. How was it better? Now, there are a lot of suggestions out there. You read the commentaries, read articles on it, on this passage, and there are a lot of different ideas. We're not going to go through those. Some of them are rather interesting, just for fun, interesting to read. But I think we just need to stick with the text. That's enough. God didn't feel like we needed to know what specifically it was about. You know, was it that you know, it was an animal sacrifice versus vegetables, grain, whatever it was. It doesn't matter. What the text says is that Abel offered his sacrifice by faith, and Cain did not. Unlike his parents, Abel made the deliberate choice to trust in God. God had laid out for them, and we don't have it recorded. God didn't feel like we needed to know it. Whatever it was, he told them about worship. This is what you're to do. This is how you're to do it. We don't know what it was, but they did. You notice Cain doesn't argue with God. Well, you didn't tell me. You didn't say it had to be a sheep. You know, he doesn't do that. Because God had told him. Abel, in this example from his life, shows us that he obeyed God in worship. Faith is closely tied to obedience. We've already seen that, and we'll keep seeing it. Faith always gives forth obedience. It gives rise to obedience. There's that connection. Works don't precede faith, but works for sure follow faith. Faith gives rise to obedience. Faith gives rise to works. The author has already said this back in, you know, we saw in verse 38 of chapter 10 that my righteous one shall live by faith. Two verses before that, he talks about when you have done the will of God. He's talking about doing the will of God. That's closely tied to faith. We can't separate those. We can't say, well, you know, we can come here Sunday morning, we can sing all these songs, and we can do whatever it is we want and call it worship, and God's good. What did God counsel Cain with? He said, if you do what is right, do right, then I'll be pleased. But if you don't do right, sin is going to take mastery over you. It's about doing right. What distinguished Abel was his inward disposition and motivation toward doing the will of God in worship. This is an example of worship. Where Cain and Abel are both worshiping God. They're both worshiping Yahweh. They both brought their gifts. They both had sacrifices. But only one of them actually obeyed God. You see, think about this larger section of Hebrews that we're in, that began in 10:19 and goes to the end of the book. It's about worship, isn't it? It's about the worship of service, or the service of worship, however you want to say that. You see, what's going on is, from 1:1 to 10:18, we have all that rich theology about Jesus, don't we? How He's superior in every way you want to look at it. Everything about Him and His new covenant and His sacrifice, it's all better. It's superior. And what the author is saying is that, okay, when you have all of that theology, it should issue forth into a life of worship and service. Those are the same thing. It's a worshipful service. Paul does the same thing in Romans, doesn't he? Chapters 1 through 11, rich theology, sometimes a little tough to grab, but it's deep. And he says, once we've waded into the deep waters of theology, we should come forth with the service of worship. And that's what he does, doesn't he, in chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. You know, this is what you should do now, is give your life in service to God. And we have the same thing here. And so in this section, from 10:19 forward, it's about worship. It's about serving God in worship. It's about how we as believer priests are to draw near to God in worship and service. Acceptable worship requires obedience in the manner of worship. You see, now yes, you know, it does apply to this whole life of worship. But Abel's example is a specific example of what we are doing today. We gather together specifically for the purpose of worshiping God. We have different ways that we do that on Sunday mornings that are prescribed by God, but we're worshiping Him. Through this act of faith, through obedient worship, Abel obtained the testimony that he was righteous. You see, by doing this God's way, by making the sacrifice God's way, whatever exactly that meant, but he was given instructions, and he followed them to the T. It was testified of him that he was righteous. The point is, you see, God accepted his sacrifice, therefore he was righteous, and because he was righteous, he had to have been a man of faith. See, that logical reasoning. And that's what he's doing here. Cain is the father of my way worship. See, there isn't anything inherently wrong with bringing things, crops that grew, because, you know, we find under the law of Moses that there was a specific place where you were to bring a grain offering, for example. And oil, the olive oil was brought, and, you know, wine was brought, and all those things that were grown from the ground. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's not what God said to do. We don't know exactly what and how he told them, but Cain said, you know, God, you gave me these rules, but I really think it'd be better if I do it my way. Hey, you think about it. How many people out there, not just today, but we really see it clearly today, where they say things like, well, you know, my God would be happy with this. And so there are churches out there that what they do is you come and you do whatever. Some of them have little stations set up. So, you know, if you want to, you know, worship God this way, you do that. And if you want to do it this way, you do that. Some of them have different rooms set up. And you got different kinds of music going on and just whatever. You know, you like rap, you like rock, you like country, whatever, you know. Just everybody do your own little thing. You want a crayon for God? Okay, that's worship. What, you know, I'm serious. And, you know, they say, I think I know what my God once in worship. I mean, go off and go worship your God, you know. And while you're at it, why don't you name him, you know, Buford or Jim Bob or something, but don't call him Yahweh. Don't call him the God of the Bible, because he's not. The God of the Bible said, this is how you worship me, and that's all that I accept. He wants obedience and worship. And just this week, I received a publication from my alma mater, and they have now a new seminary program, Media Arts and Worship. Man, come on, people, really? I mean, the guy that's heading it up, he's a neat guy. I think he loves the Lord, but I disagree with him on this. It's not about media arts. You don't find that in the Psalms. It's about our heart. It's about coming before God in reverence and awe and joy and mixing that all together and, you know, and offering that to the Lord. It's not my way worship, it's God's way. God knows how he wants to be worshipped, and he's told us. And that's why Abel set apart. He obeyed God in worship. And we find that he had this testimony. I mean, think about how great Abel's testimony is. It says, though he is dead, he still speaks. Abel has a living voice, even right now. We just read about him. He has a living voice. I love what Luther said. He pointed out that while Abel wasn't capable of teaching his brother about true faith while alive, Abel is now more alive than ever, because having died in faith, he teaches the whole world. And you think about that. Here's a guy who died young, but he died in faith. And saints throughout the ages, through the Old Testament times and now in the New Testament times, Abel still speaking to us. Live by faith. At both ends of this catalog of the faithful, we have those who died for their faith. We have Abel, and we're going to have those in Old Testament, or further on into the Old Testament times, who died for their faith. These suffering saints, these persecuted readers needed to hear that. They needed to hear that what is pleasing to God is obeying Him in worship, and even if you die for it, you have this living voice, and others can learn from it. Now, so first we said, imitate Abel. Obey God in worship. And second, imitate Enoch. Please God by earnestly seeking Him. Please God by earnestly seeking Him. I'd like you to turn back to Genesis with me, this time to Genesis 5. Let's read the brief account of Enoch, someone that we don't talk a lot about, but yet he stands out by faith. Okay, Genesis 5, and beginning in verse 18. And Jared lived 162 years and became the father of Enoch. Then Jared lived 800 years after he became the father of Enoch. And he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died. And Enoch lived 65 years and became the father of Methuselah. Then Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Okay, now back to Hebrews 11:5. One of the things that we have to guard against is taking one example from Scripture and making it the way. You see, we could look at Abel's testimony, his experience, and say, you know what's really spiritual? You know what's really pleasing to God? Is dying early for your faith. So let's go out there and try to get ourselves killed. Let's go preach Jesus in, you know, Iran or wherever and get killed. We'll be the really spiritual ones. Well, we have to guard against that. Abel lived a short life and died. Enoch lived a long life and didn't die. You see, so you just have that, the exact opposite. But what was the same is that they both lived by faith. If you are to die, die by faith. If you're not to die, then live by faith. Hebrews 11:5. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death, and he was not found because God took him up. For he obtained the witness that before being taken up, he was pleasing to God. Now, when you read Genesis 5, one of the things that you're struck with as it goes through each person, okay, and then Seth lived a whole many years and he died. And the next guy lived a lot of years and he died. The next guy lived a lot of years and he died. And they just all the way through the chapter. Except somewhere in the middle there, you have Enoch. He lived a whole lot of years and he didn't die. And that stands out, jumps out. And you're like, And the Spirit of God wants to just hook us with that. Say, okay, I want to pull you to this. I want you to pay attention. There's something significant about Enoch that I want you to get. He walked with God. The Bible talks about God transferring Enoch. You know, Enoch was one day walking along the earth and God transferred him from here to heaven. I like how one of the translations put it, God promoted him. You know, and they paraphrased it. But as amazing as that is, you know, he says that, you know, he wasn't found because God took him. You know, you can see. People are looking for Enoch. Haven't seen him today. Look in his tent. Not there. Go look out in the field. Not there. You know, if you had a workshop and look in there, no. Gone. That's what he says he wasn't found. I couldn't find him. There's no body. And usually somebody dies and, you know, most of the time you find a body. No body. But what's even more significant is that it says that he was pleasing to God. But it's the highest compliment that could be ever said of any person, right? That he pleased God. Really, that is. To hear that, well done, good and faithful servant. That's the highest compliment that any of us could ever achieve. Now, if you remember when we read it from Genesis, the translation of the Hebrew there said he walked with God. Well, then it comes through the Greek and then into our English and it says he pleased God. Well, which is it? Well, it's both. It's the same thing. You see, because walking with God means to enjoy a relationship of harmonious fellowship with Him. See, that's what this whole idea of walking with God. So, you know, if I and one of you are walking and we're you know, just going to take a walk and walking down the sidewalk together, there's this harmonious fellowship that's taking place. And that's what he's describing here with Enoch and God. He walked with God. They had this harmonious fellowship. So if you're in that kind of a relationship with God, the only way that could happen is if you're pleasing to God. You see, as he walked with God, he pleased God. It wasn't like, you know, at some point, you know, Lord, oh, okay, I can't do that. I'm going to go do this. No, he walked with God in harmony. So to walk with God is to please God. Now, you may be saying, yeah, I don't remember reading the word faith in there, though. So how does this guy feel like he can say it was by faith that he did this? He says, okay, I got you. Verse 6. He put that in there for you skeptics. You don't believe me? Well, he says, and without faith it is impossible to please him, that is God. For he who comes to God must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who seek Him. He's saying that if, you know, I know it doesn't say in the Old Testament that it was by faith, but I'm telling you it is. It was by faith. Because you see, if he walked with God, then it's true that he pleased God. And if he pleased God, then it is true that he did it by faith. Why? Because of this principle I'm going to give you, he says. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. There's no way ever that you can please God without faith. You can work as hard as you want. You can do as many good works as you want. You can say as many prayers and anything else you want. Do all the religious duties you can think of. You can come to church every Sunday and be the only person with a perfect attendance record. And if you don't have faith, you're not going to please God. That's what he's saying. This is a principle. He doesn't say, well, you know, you can get there, but it's just really hard to get there without faith. He doesn't say that, does he? Did you see that? Did you see in there, and without faith, it's just really hard to please God. No, he says this is a moral necessity. Without faith, it's impossible to please God because the one who wants to come to God must believe these things. We're back to worship again, though. Did you notice that? The one who comes to God. Coming to God is an act of worship. That's what we're talking about. Remember 10:19? We started this whole section. How do we approach? Remember, it's with boldness that we come before God. He's talking about worship again. The one who comes to God is a worshiper. Coming to God is a deliberate approach. It requires that relationship. You see, the one who comes to God, like Enoch, must believe these two things. What are they? It's imperative that we believe at least two things. And he's not necessarily being exhaustive here, but he says if you don't have these, you don't have faith. You're not going to please God. First, God exists. That's very basic. How can you have faith in God if you don't believe he exists? You know, faith should, I know today people have faith in faith. There's no object to their faith because it's wishful thinking. But genuine faith has an object. In other words, something that it rests in. You know, people a lot of times will use, you know, a chair as an example, or I could use this platform or the ground as an example that I feel like, you know, this platform is going to hold me up. It has so far, you know, so I, in a sense, not a great illustration, but I have faith. That's I stepped up here because I believed it was going to hold me up. Okay. Faith has to have an object. God is unseen, but we've already seen that faith gets us past that unseen hurdle, right? It gets us over that. Even though we can't see God, we still can believe that he exists. Because it's the conviction. Faith is the conviction of things that we can't see. Now, there are people out there who try really hard to convince themselves that God doesn't exist. But what's even more tragic is that there are so many who live as if it really doesn't matter. How many of us do that? Sometimes, often. How many times do we live as if it doesn't really matter if God exists? I mean, that's what people would conclude by looking at how we live. And here's my challenge to us all. Live so that it's obvious that God exists. What do you want to happen is that, you know, as you're walking through life and the way you live is people say, boy, that guy, he sure believes God exists. That lady, boy, you can tell she believes that God exists. Look at her life. It's all over her life. There's no doubting that. Live so that it's obvious that God exists. Now, we're no better than a demon if that's all we believe, that God exists. James 2:19. And so our author gives us another truth that is critical for us to believe. Believe that God exists. And second, believe that God rewards those who seek Him. We have the conviction by faith that God does exist and He rewards those who seek Him. Now, I mentioned earlier that God rewards His followers, those who seek Him. He rewards us with a breathtaking gift. And the gift is mentioned here in this verse. Do you notice it? Those who seek all the stuff. Did it say that? Those who seek the crowns we're going to get. No. What do they seek? God. They seek Him. Because that's the real treasure. That's the breathtaking gift. Because God says that if you, by faith, follow Me, you seek Me, then I'm going to reward you with Me. For the man or woman of faith, God is the reward. God is the breathtaking, most wonderful reward. Psalm 43, that psalmist there, as he's drawing near to God in worship, he tells us why he draws near to God in worship. He calls God my exceeding joy. That's why I come to Him. That's why I pursue Him. That's why, even though I keep getting knocked down and the world is pulling at me and everything is, you know, it might go wrong at times, that God is my exceeding joy. We talked about the promise made to Abraham. And, you know, Abraham was told what his reward would be. In Genesis 15:1, God said to Abraham, I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward. That's how we should translate that. God says, I am your exceedingly great reward. You know, there really aren't enough words. I mean, the exceedingly great, you know, we kind of get the idea, but not really. You know, I mean, that's not enough to explain that God is our reward, that we get Him. Believers find in God their deepest satisfaction. Only in Him we find our deepest satisfaction. Our greatest joy is in Him. It is Him. See, for the person of faith, that's how they think. What does a seeking mean? It's wholeheartedly pursuing the Creator. Now, to the person who isn't a person of faith, that doesn't really sound all that good. Okay, I'm going to work all this, you know, through this life and put up with hardships and everything, and you're just telling me I get God? What kind of gift is that? What kind of reward is that? I mean, tell me I've got this enormous mansion and it's going to be filled up to nearly the top in gold, and I can go in there and wallow in it, and you know, and come out with different crowns every day. You know, tell me something like that. Don't tell me, you know, I get God. But that's not the thinking of a person of faith. The person of faith is able to say, the very greatest thing I could ever get is God. And if I got nothing else, I've got everything still. You see, because God is the greatest reward. For men and women of faith, we consider God the greatest treasure, and we seek Him. So this seeking is wholeheartedly pursuing the Creator because we want to discover how wonderful our Creator is. You see, here's again this whole concept of the creature, us, and the Creator, and us submitting ourselves to Him, and us pursuing Him because we want to discover how wonderful He is. I mean, we know He's wonderful. The Scriptures tell us all over He's wonderful. We hear each other say and sing that He's wonderful. But you know, what we need to do is we need to, each of us, in the walk that we have day by day, trial by trial, is to look for how wonderful is this God. You see, it's all the little things. Just like in our human relationships, the relationship itself and learning the little things about each other that makes it special and rich. With God, seeking Him deepens the creature-creator relationship. Seeking God means diligent investigation, you know, with the goal of discovery. I was talking with a brother this morning about this. You know, as we go through the various trials in life, what we should be doing is, you know, looking under every grief, looking around every trial, and say, God, show me how beautiful You are. Show me the excellencies of Your grace and of Your character. Faith seeks God in order to deepen the relationship. You see, as the relationship deepens, the satisfaction deepens. Because the more we know about God, the deeper we know Him, the greater our reward. The greater we realize is our reward. You see, that's what He's talking about. So, let me give us a better response to trials, a better request to make than our usual questions of why, you know, why me, you know, why this, why now, or, you know, how are you going to get me through this? Let me give us a better request. Whenever you undergo a trial, and it could be a hardship, a grief, suffering, persecution, but it might be you're struggling with apathy, despondency, discouragement. You may be fighting with sin, trying to resist it. This should be our request. Lord, reward me in this trial. Say to the Lord, Lord, you know, when I go through trials, I always learn something about myself, and it usually isn't pretty. But Lord, as I go through this trial, teach me how to investigate Your character so that I discover something more about Your beauty. As I'm in this trial, help me to look at all the little things in it to see Your grace, Your mercy, Your loving kindness. Help me to see Your fingerprints all over this and to see how great is Your beauty. Let our request be this. When we enter trials, Lord, reward me with more of You.